welcome to Watch the Throne. What a lovely day. This is episode 2, 2 Days in the Valley from 1996. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And here we talked about it a little bit last week. We go from wordless...
Glorified extra
to not a star, but there's no real star of this movie, but a prominent featured role where if you didn't know better, you'd be like, oh, this woman's been acting forever. Like, it's just, she's just a main part of this movie. It's like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, she's I guess this is her breakout role, you would call it, because yeah. She does go from like 0 to 60 with this movie, basically. Like, where'd she come from? Nowhere. Like, she's just automatically on the scene, holding her own with, like, you know, all these other established actors.
And so what I said I was going to do on the last episode, to sort of see if I could track where she went, or how she got from wordless extra to primetime player, I looked on her wiki, I looked in sort of her history, and I found some facts, nothing that shows what happened here, but some things that I found, one at least that you know, or actually a couple at least that you know about, because I talked to you about last night. I did not know that in June 1991, Charlize's father, an alcoholic, threatened both her and her mother, attacked her mother, and then her mother shot and killed him and was ruled self-defense and got off, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that not too long ago, actually, but then wondering, like, where did this news come from? And apparently it was sort of out there the whole time, but what a experience to draw from. I mean, is that... possibly, you know, having these life experiences to draw from, like, make you a better actor? I don't know. But that is intense and quite unfortunate and crazy and scary and all that stuff.
Also, as a kid, she had jaundice, which I didn't know that people still got, but I guess, you know, in different parts of the world, maybe that's still around. Due to antibiotics, her teeth rotted away and had to be removed. And she said, I had no teeth until I was 11. I had these fangs because I had jaundice when I was a kid. I was put on so many antibiotics that my teeth rotted. They had to cut them out, so I never had baby teeth, which is also kind of crazy. I guess her teeth, like, I think she has real teeth, but I guess just all of her baby teeth are gone. Maybe the front teeth. Maybe, like you were saying, maybe the front teeth are fake. I don't know.
That's the other thing. Like, I had just heard a rumor that she had, like, lost her front teeth or something, and, I mean, it all travels back to this source. But, yeah, I mean, nowadays, you look at, like, I mean, everybody's got the implants now, actually, anyway, right? The older they get. If you look at Iron Man 1, and then you look at Spider-Man Homecoming, it's like Robert Downey Jr.'s definitely got some sweet new teeth.
Well, we've also noticed on this podcast, or this network, that both Cage and Zac Efron have gotten their teeth fixed, so yeah. It's not uncommon. She got a modeling gig in Milan, and so she and her mother moved, I think, from South Africa to Milan, and then moved to America, where she trained as a ballet dancer. So I'm excited to see Charlize if she's going to dance in movies. We're gonna get to that, I hope. But then a knee injury ended her career, and so she then bought a plane ticket and flew to L.A. with her mother's money to become an actress.
Nice. Well, I guess fate stepped in, you know, hurt her knee so that she could follow this dream. This is kind of stupid, but it's just funny how, like, knee injuries... For some reason, my mind went to the wrestler Goldberg, who was, like, an NFL player and then, like, okay, busted his knee, but then became, like, this enormous, like, breakout wrestler for a while in the late 90s, early 2000s, I guess.
Goldberg is the Charlize Theron of wrestling?
Possibly? I don't know.
So after she flew to L.A., she was cashing a check at a Hollywood Boulevard bank. Cashier would not cash the check, and she just got to a screaming match. And so the guy literally behind her online, as the story goes, was an agent, and he gave her his card. Apparently she fired him pretty quickly because he just kept sending her screenplays like Showgirls and Species. And so like, I guess, like, you know, either terrible movies or
that got made
movies, or, you know, maybe ones where she just had to be naked all the time. Who knows?
But well, Showgirls definitely is like a full on nude scene the entire movie. But Species was like a cool sort of crazy alien Geiger type of creature that comes to Earth and, like, Michael Madsen hunts it down.
So that's unfortunate, I guess, in terms of, you know, depending on why she didn't like that. Maybe she just wanted bigger things. But the fact that I read early on in her career that I took note of was that in 1999, apparently Playboy bought pictures of her when she was a model before she made it big, and they ran them in her in the magazine as though she had just done them or something, and she sued the magazine.
Nice.
And lost.
Whoa.
Yeah, so they still out there. But yeah, I guess when she was a model, you know, when she was 18, 19, whatever, before she was an actress or a known actress, she did some, like, topless modeling. And I mean, again, we'll get to it in this movie. She's topless in this movie, and the sort of the implications of all of that. It just sort of sucks that, you know, 1999, you know, after The Devil's Advocate, after she's a pretty big name already, Playboy's like, hey, like, check out this actress who just posed for us. It's like, no, she, you know, this is a while ago or whatever. So that kind of sucks.
Yeah, that blows. But I mean, at least she fought it. You know, that's cool. Like, she has balls. Like, she's definitely a tough person. And like, just from the screaming match at the bank story, like, you could tell, like, she's just not going to take shit and she's going to just try and protect herself as best as possible, I suppose. But just glad to hear that she tried to get that taken care of if possible. But you know what the hell, Playboy, like like, why can't you just say, like, these were pictures from before she was famous or however? I mean, it's just weird that they added that, like, lie to it. Is strange. I mean,
yeah,
just,
I don't know the context. Yeah,
are they gonna sell less issues, you know, based on what's written in the... No, I don't think so.
I don't know. All in all, my research, I still had no sense of how she got from featured extra to primetime player, as I keep saying. But I think your guess is probably as good as any, that she just started nailing auditions. This movie, 2 Days in the Valley, was written and directed by this guy named John Herzfeld, mm-hmm. who I don't know if I've seen another one of his movies, but of important note, at least to me, my Zack Attack co-host, Joe Two, one of his all-time favorite bad movies is Casualties of Love, the Long Island Lolita story.
Oh, Amy Fisher?
Which is also written and directed by this guy. And so I told him
shit.
He freaked out about that. So,
which Amy? Who plays Amy Fisher? Is that the Drew Barrymore one?
Let me see here. Hang on.
By the way, I was like alive and in kind of a kid, I guess, when that happened. But that was major with Joey Buttafuoco and, you know...
Alyssa Milano.
Oh, that's the Alyssa Milano one. Wow, yeah. Then that's, you know, they made two. It was sort of like Volcano and Dante's Peak. It was going on with the Long Island Lolita back then.
So I saw that and I was just like, because I was like, who is John Herzfeld? And I looked. Oh, the only other movie of his that I'd seen is this Sylvester Stallone movie from a couple years ago called Reach Me, which was terrible.
What?
And I was like,
Never
like,
heard
he's
of that.
He's not the star of it. He's just like a supporting character. It's super weird. There was
just
like
kind of in it, yo. I'm a glorified extra.
But I was like, who is this guy? And I was like, oh my God. Because I'd never heard of that movie, except I know that Joe loves it. So
awesome.
Here we are, 2 Days in the Valley.
Great. Back at the Valley, man. I mean, come on. It all kind of started here with Valley Girl and...
We Are Your Friends.
We Are Your Friends. Like, so many references. I mean, even Keanu ended up with his body buried up to his head in the valley at one point.
That's very true. There's very important beginnings and endings in the valley in the Cage Club Podcast Network history. I feel like this movie on a whole really wants to be a Shane Black movie. I thought early on, because it came out in 96, 2 years after Pulp Fiction, I felt like it wanted to be a Tarantino Pulp Fiction sort of movie, and then I was like, no, like, that's not really what it's going for. I think it's trying to go for that, like, Shane Black, like, funny, charming, you know, action with a mystery set in LA movie, and, like, it just doesn't work.
I remember when this came out, and this was definitely marketed as, you know, if you liked Pulp Fiction and, you know, irreverent hitmen running around getting involved in day-to-day stuff.
If you want more Eric Stoltz.
There you go. If you love these stories that interconnect and cross over at certain times,
yep.
It might be told out of order. You're going to love this. I hear you, man. I think, like, nowadays, this feels more like a Shane Black rip because we got that great Shane Black film about, like, a year or so ago. The Nice Guys, and I could totally feel like a lot of that in here, but there's just too many characters to pull that off. That's what's so great about The Nice Guys. It's like, it's this buddy cop kind of, or buddy detective thing, and it's basically these two guys bouncing off each other. Here, it just kind of gets lost in the characters, and I liked it a lot more back like 20 years ago when I first watched it, but I don't feel like it aged well at all.
Is it weird to think that you haven't seen a movie in 20 years? Like, that seems crazy to me, right?
That blew my mind. Like, sitting and actually thinking about it and how much I actually remembered this, and I remembered renting it on VHS and, you know, and then remembered watching it again on cable. It has been a long time since I've seen this movie, but I gotta tell you, like, I remember 90% of it. It's crazy how much I recalled. I was watching it going, like, I feel like I just watched this yesterday or something.
I feel like it's memorable because a lot of the things are, like, close to being cool or close to being, like, there's just little deviations that sort of, like, and what's also kind of frustrating is that there's some people who are really, really good in this movie, I think. Like, I don't think I'm too biased in saying this, but I do think that Charlize might be the best part of this movie, or if not the best, one of the best parts.
Okay.
I think Terry Hatcher is really good in this movie. I think Eric Stoltz is really good in this movie. And I think the twist that Terry Hatcher is in on this murder, which we'll get to, I was like, oh, like, I didn't expect that at all, which I thought was, I don't know if I was just into the movie or thinking about my recast game or whatever, but I was like, okay. And so, as the movie went on, like, there were more and more things I liked about it. Instead of liking the movie more, I kind of got a little more frustrated and like, well, there's so much that I like, I don't know why I don't like the whole thing more. Mm-hmm. Other than just not really liking the Danny Aiello stuff, like, at all.
Oh, really? See, I was just going to say, I could have just watched a movie of the Danny Aiello stuff.
Really?
I mean, or pick any one of these threads, and let's just streamline this thing. I feel like there's stuff in here that's totally superfluous. Like, you could make this movie without the Eric Stoltz, Jeff Daniels characters.
Absolutely.
You know, you could pull so many characters out of this movie and make it much cleaner and better. I mean, it could even you could even just pull out that whole Danny Aiello stuff, and the movie will play fine as well. Like, there's ways to work it around, and we'll get to them, but the Teddy character, like, what is up with that thread? Like, there's just so much stuff here. It's just too much. Like, too many ideas, and it feels like a guy who thought that maybe he'd never get a chance to say anything again, so unfortunately, like, what he's trying to say feels lost in the mix.
It's just, it's weird, because, like, it feels like for a while, it's kind of like an anthology movie, like, check out all the different ways of, like, the seedy underbelly of L.A., kind of, but it doesn't really get, like, super dark, but it's, like, hitmen and affairs and, like, out-of-town hitmen and, like, maid guys and, like, a suicidal writer and, like, so it's sort of like, look at all these different stories that don't really interact with each other, sort of kind of like New York, I Love You. Like,
I knew it. I knew
Shia,
it. We're
right?
Going to go to Valley, I Love You. I want that so bad now that you said it, and I totally agree, man. This would have worked way better if there were just vignettes. I think that's why Pulp Fiction works, is he balances the tone way better. He breaks it up with chapter cards. They're almost like his, especially Pulp Fiction, it's almost just like three short films in a lot of ways.
Yep.
Like, you could just watch any part of those and just be like, okay, that was great. Here you can't. Here you can't just like take a story thread because they intersect and intercut too much.
It's cool when things intersect in a slight way where like Jeff Daniels is at the stoplight. James Spader, shout out to Cinemaker, shout out to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, pulls up next to him and Jeff Daniels is playing with that water gun, and I'm like, oh, look, like, these are two threads. They don't interact. They don't really get in touch with each other for the rest of the movie. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. Where the movie falls apart is that they're like, we have all these, like, these six different stories, and they're all going to converge in one. It's like, well, that doesn't have to happen. Like, we don't
exactly
have to wrap everything up. It works sometimes, but then other times, it's sort of like the geography doesn't really work, where, like, and I'm jumping way ahead to the end, but, like, you know, Charlize gets shot, and then somehow, like, stumbles from that hotel to the house. I'm like,
oh,
how
yeah,
far
yeah
away was that? Like, she, like,
yeah,
you know, on her, like, last breath, staggers seemingly across town, across L.A.
Or if not, like, up a giant hill while shot in the
and
in
gets
the
to the house before everybody else who were, like, in cars driving to the house. Like, it's like, what is happening?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it feels like this movie was reverse engineered from the ending at times. Because, like, it's like, I know I want everybody to be in this climax, but how do I get them there? And a lot of it just becomes way too coincidental. Like, the suicidal writer, he's at, like, the graveyard, and he runs into that woman, the nurse.
Right.
And the nurse just happens to be the art dealer's stepsister, and she was on her way over, and when they get here, it's the same guy who's being held up by Danny Aiello and held hostage. Like, it just feels like it needed everything to connect, and it totally didn't. You needed to have some characters who never even saw each other, didn't even know they existed. Yeah, it just feels like it had to get this done, and you're totally right. Like, they did not all need to converge.
And it's like, when she's like, oh, I want you to meet my brother who's going to take the dog, I was like, oh, no, that's almost certainly going to be James Spader. And I'm like, no,
oh,
like, it's just
twist.
One step ahead of James Spader. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, like, I knew that it was going to be somebody we knew. I just guessed the wrong person.
Watching it this time, here's what bothered me story-wise early on. So early on, James Spader and Danny Aiello are these two hitmen, and they're going to kill
Terry Hatcher's.
They're going to kill Terry. Yeah, so they're going to kill Terry Hatcher's ex-husband. And after they do that, James Spader is gonna shoot Danny Aiello and blow him up in a car and frame him for that murder, right?
Let's pause for 1 second. So
Okay.
So James Spader is like an out-of-town hitman, I think, right? Who's been brought in?
Oh, no, I think it's the reverse. He's the L.A. guy, and Danny Aiello's, like, from New York.
A maid guy from New York, yes.
Yeah.
I thought they were both out-of-town. Maybe, so there's also an added wrinkle to this, is that there's Charlize is, like, referenced as this, like, Norwegian?
Swedish.
Swedish. Eastern European blonde who's like involved in this somehow. And at the beginning of the movie, we see that she's dead. She's topless, covered in blood in a photograph. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, I don't think she's dead because I know she's in this movie, but like maybe they're all flashbacks or something. So I was like, oh, we got another death. But I want to clarify the way that I got, I guess it makes more sense that James Spader is an LA hitman, but it almost seems like Danny Aiello came in to like, it's almost like he's an actor studying for a role and taking a ride along with a cop. He's just like, hey, like, let's see how you guys do this out here, but he's not doing anything. Like, James Spader is looking through those binoculars at Terry Hatcher's house. Danny Aiello is not looking through them. He's just like, hey, what's going on? Like, he's literally saying, hey, what's going on? What's she saying? What's happening? And then we don't get answers. Like, we see it as the viewer, but James Spader's not letting, so it, like, the whole thing is weird.
Yeah. Yeah, the setup is already a problem, and we're not even to the issue I wanted to bring up yet, which is crazy. Like, these guys feel like I want to have just like these Tweedledee and Tweedledum kind of thing. I don't know. It's like I want these guys to be funny and snappy, but I also want them to be threatening. But it just doesn't make any sense to me, basically. Like, I don't get the dynamic between these two. I don't know why they're working together.
You don't get it because there is no dynamic. Like, they don't have a history. Yeah. They're basically strangers who are just thrown in a car together.
Yeah, and that doesn't work. Yeah, I mean, I have all the same issues. So, like, I'm not on board with these two this time around as to, like, what is happening. I'm basically just, like, constantly confused, even though I know what's going to happen. My big problem, though, that I had is, like, after Danny Aiello survives his car bombing, he goes to those people's house and is like, the guy who did this is going to come after me. And then it's like, no, he thinks he succeeded in destroying you. Like, later on, there's a scene where he's like, ah, I blew him up in the car. He's done for. So I knew when that came out of Danny Aiello's mouth, like, there were going to be big story problems coming along, like lots of plot holes, like instant convenience, just because we have to get on with it. Stuff like that was going to occur. I sort of like backtracked in my mind. I was like, well, that's why there's no character development. They just really just jump in with the stuff. Like, we just want to, let's just open this movie with a guy getting shot in the head next to his wife sleeping in bed, you know? Like, let's just do it. It doesn't matter. That's just what we want in our movie. We'll work it out.
Two little things. That guy, so Terry Hatcher's ex-husband who gets killed at the beginning of the movie, that sort of sets this movie off, he was in Children of the Corn. So...
Oh,
that's a pretty
nice.
cool connection, because I was like, who is this guy?
The first Children of the Corn, right?
The first, like, Children of the Corn, yes. Yeah. So I clicked on his name on Letterboxd, and it's not, you know, I don't know what he's the star of, but his most popular movie that he's been in at all was Children of the Corn. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. But in terms of Danny Aiello, why I didn't like him at all in this movie is that he falls into that trap that I've had a problem with in a lot of movies lately, where I'm not offended by bad language at all. But I am offended by the use of bad language as a crutch. Like, look at this New York guy. He's cursing every other word because, like, that's how he talks. Like, look how real and authentic this is. It's like, well, no. Like, this year I saw The Sopranos. I'm like, they all, like, obviously curse and they all whatever. But, like, they are also people who aren't, like, stereotypes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So... it was difficult for me when I was recasting that part, and we'll get to this at the end of the episode, the recast game, is like I had at one point James Gandolfini there because I think he could have done a better job, but I was like, no, this like is below him. Like, I don't want to put him in this movie. Like, he would be elevating it too much. Like, you kind of need, and I think what I landed on is pretty good. It bothered me how lazy that felt.
Yeah, I think the movie's filled with that with every character, though. Every character in the movie is set up with one note like that. Danny Aiello, like, oh, he also has a stupid name, Dosmo, instead of Cosmo or whatever.
Yep.
Like, just because, just to make him sillier. Like, there's no explanation to that. He's the cursing guy from Brooklyn, hey. And then you got James Spader, who is the clockmaster from Arrow or whatever. Like, he's got his 1 minute rule when he kills somebody. You got Eric Stoltz, who's like the vice cop with a heart of gold. You got his partner, who's just like super strung out. You have Terry Hatcher, who's the four time, or like she comes in fourth place all the time in the Olympics. Like, that's her only defining characteristic.
I was like, why are you an Olympic skier? Where did that come from?
Just because she needs a character trait. Like, literally, like, everybody just has like this one thing that makes them who they are, you know? Like, Charlize Theron is just this beautiful sort of Marilyn Monroe type.
I had Marilyn Monroe in my recast originally. I was like, no, I can't take her.
No, we gotta get a little... I think we should keep it to people who are either alive or just, like, modern.
Well... We'll see. So one thing I do want to talk about, you sort of led me right into that, is that this movie, and I'm trying to wear my feminist glasses when watching these movies now, especially with Charlize at the front and center of everything we're doing. This movie is terrible to women from start to finish.
Oh, absolutely horrible.
So a few notes. Terry Hatcher does not wear pants for the first hour of the movie.
Right.
She finally puts on like little sort of like bicycle shorts by the end.
Oh, and her ex-husband in like one of the opening scenes is like groping her and like
getting a little
practically
rapey.
Like, yeah. I was like ready to turn it off.
And she's like, no. Charlize is first shown, like I said before, topless in bed, covered in blood. And he's like, look what happened to your ex or whatever.
In a photograph even. Yep. Isn't even appearing on screen in alive or anything, but like is a picture of her.
Later on, when we next see Charlize, I mean, she's also like in this abusive relationship with James Spader where like it seems like she's kind of into it, but I feel like that's just sort of like convenient writing.
We gotta sort of like decode this whole like relationship triangle thing happening with her and Terry Hatcher's husband. I don't know what is going on with the North Koreans. What?
We'll come back to Charlize in a second. There's also the mousy assistant played by Glenn Headley, who is Susan in this movie. She is... So, did you watch... When we did it for Zack Attack, did you watch New Year's Eve? Have you seen New
Year's
Eve?
So yes, I have.
She reminded me of Michelle Pfeiffer in that movie, where it's just like... Oh, like I also had Michelle Pfeiffer as a choice or re-guest, but I didn't do her. She's very clearly a beautiful woman that they like frizzied up her hair and put glasses on. Like,
oh yeah, look she, how, she's
look
all
how
that
homely
in her.
She is exactly in like, but like never gave her the break free. The only one who sees her true beauty is Danny Aiello. He's like, no, you're beautiful. Like fuck that. Like you're beautiful. And I'm like, oh, like that's. But like the whole movie, she's just like this weak, beaten down woman who kind of has a redemption arc at the end, but also her redemption arc of just driving off in the sunset with a made man feels weird. Like it doesn't really feel like a victory. It feels like he sees you for who you are, and that's cool, but like he's also kind of a bad guy, sort of?
Right. He's a killer. At least like the guy she was working for, he might have been like a British asshole, which was his only defining trait, who screamed a lot, but like, I don't know, it seems like you're trading a screaming abusive relationship for one of a danger and always being, you know, having to look over your shoulder if you're going to be with this other guy, which also seems kind of abusive.
It's very strange. And that's pretty much it in terms of women. There's like the three women in the movie and that's it, really. The nurse. The nurse is okay. I mean, the nurse isn't bad. She doesn't have much to do.
And then there are those two real detectives. I think one of those is a woman, but those guys,
they get shot.
Yeah, they get shot like right away or something. They totally didn't need to be in this movie.
No. So getting back to Charlize in terms of that relationship. So I think what happened, this is a very complicated murder plot, and I don't understand what happened, really.
Which is a problem. Before we get into it, I just want to say, like, if your movie is going to be jumping across, like, lots of storylines and intersecting and being complex, you need a basic thread. You need the story to be very easy to understand. The audience needs to know what's going on, even if the characters in the film haven't caught on yet. Like,
right.
Again, I think that's why Pulp Fiction works really well, because it's really easy to follow.
Yep.
Even though you're jumping around, it feels more complex than it actually is.
So here's the plot as best, the murder plot, not the plot of the movie, but the murder plot, which is most of it, which happens before the movie starts. So see if this is right for the most part. Terry Hatcher is married to the guy from Children of the Corn. They get a divorce. She is well off. She's paying him alimony. He has great life insurance or something.
Right.
So she cooks up this plan to have him killed.
Yes.
Part of this plan, for some reason, is to get Charlize to start dating him.
This is where it starts to get so confusing, because she's like, I was at the Olympics and saw you with Charlize. And he's like, oh, did that make you get fourth place or whatever? And I was like, why is she trying to convince the guy she's trying to kill that she's not in on it? Like, I don't understand what her cover, why she's covering for herself. I can't follow it. I don't know why he's questioned about meeting Charlize Theron in Switzerland and the North Koreans. Like, and then did he lie about that? And like, what did that confirm? And what is happening? I don't know. I can't understand why they want it to be so complex with such a simple idea, you know?
Right.
Just make it simpler. It's not helping.
She hires James Spader to kill Children of the Corn guy. Part of his plan is to get Charlize to date him. And then when they all come back to LA from the Olympics, Terry Hatcher knows that they're going to kill him at some point. They don't know, or she doesn't know, that they're going to do it in her house.
Yeah.
And so Danny Aiello and James Spader go. James Spader, because he's like, I guess, kind of, he feels like, this character trait feels more like a serial killer than a hitman. He's got like his thing, and his thing is like, you have a minute to live and you're going to answer questions. If you lie, you die. It's like, okay.
Reminded me of The Watcher with Keanu.
I don't know why this is happening. He drugs Terry Hatcher so she gets knocked out. He kills Children of the Corn guy. He drives off and he shoots Danny Aiello in the stomach. And Danny Aiello is wearing a bulletproof vest, we find out, twice in this movie.
Same vest, I think.
Same vest, probably. Then, like, basically pushes the car off. Sets a bomb that's in the trunk that is going to blow up the car. And at the last second, Danny Aiello jumps out, rolls down the hill.
We don't see
it. And lands in the art dealer and his assistant Susan's house or whatever.
Backyard, yeah.
So that's a really roundabout way of saying, I don't know why Terry Hatcher doesn't say, hey, James Spader, kill this guy. He's like, all right, cool. And then just does it. I like that Charlize is in this because she's good in this role, but like, I don't know why her character is involved in this plot.
Yeah, it's really strange. I don't know what it is. It's needlessly complex. Like, you're absolutely right. Like, this movie could have been 5 minutes long. Like, it could have just been like, kill my husband. All right, bang. I mean, this is just all about weird characters doing illegal shit behind other people's backs and trying to be like a dark comedy about the valley and the weird characters going on in the seedy underground that you're not aware of. I don't know. I just feel like a lot of this just falls really flat. Like, everybody is just playing it too big. Everyone's really drawing a lot of attention to themselves to the point where it's almost like distracting at times. I don't know. I'm having issues with a lot of this movie.
What further sort of complicates things is this like weird love triangle. Like it feels like James Spader thinks that Charlize, in setting up Terry Hatcher's ex-husband to die, James Spader thinks that Charlize developed feelings for him, or mm-hmm. at least that they actually had sex.
Yeah.
And so he's taking out all this like impotent rage on Charlize. She looks cool and badass in the car when we first see her, but he's like already kind of like choking her and it's being, you know, uncomfortable and
rough
weird.
Sex, yeah.
And then we go back to their hotel room or their motel room or whatever, and she comes out of the bathroom in lingerie. And I think this is probably, unfortunately, why she was cast in so many things so quickly, is because, like, look at her. Like, she's beautiful in the scene and, like, also really good. They just start having, like, rough sex that she's not into. Like, James Spader is just, like, a really bad guy, but, like, it takes so long, I think, for him to get what's coming to him. And he's not in the movie enough that it sort of feels like when he does die, it's not like a relief that he's dead. It's like a, oh, hey, look, the suicidal writer killed him. Like, look at the triumphant victory for him. It's just like,
yeah. Dude, I was totally thinking of Twin Peaks The Return at the end of that with, like, the surprise save with a bullet. That's totally just like what it made me think of. When Lucy comes into the sheriff's office at the end and shoots Mr. C, I was like, oh, that just happened. Again, man, I'm just going to keep saying it. There's just too much to follow. Like, I would have loved James Spader and Charlize Theron and just do Terry Hatcher, and then you get two of the cops in there and that's it. And like, let's just follow this demented, like you said, hitman and his weird girlfriend and their crazy relationship and what they do. And like, you're probably right. Like, this guy's totally impotent. That's where he got the minute thing from. He's probably got a small dick and only lasts like 60 seconds. And so like, he's developed this whole threatening persona about having control of time and all that kind of bullshit. He's got this knockout girlfriend, but he can only control her through being physically abusive. It's just too much going on with like all the other things to really connect to this, because as they're starting to develop and like you're getting into it, they cut away to something else. Like in the middle of their sex scene, like they literally fade to black and go to like another scene with a whole other group of characters. And that's just very jarring. Like, I was just getting into this. Like, I need more time with everybody like in a row. Like, I think there's too much editing going on between the segments. Like, let us sit with these characters longer and then move on for a while, because I can't just keep coming back and forth like this. There's too many of them for me.
It's the whole thing we've been saying, like, why not streamline, right? Like, why not in any way? Like, it seems like every decision along the way was made to complicate things.
What worked for me was, like, when the British guy was having the, like, stomach pains, and we find out that he passes a kidney stone. It's just because, I guess, it's in there. But what was cool is, like, as he's writhing in pain in the middle of the road, there's this carjacker across the street, and the carjacker, like, goes over, picks him up, and, like, puts him in the back back of the car and presumably drives him to the hospital. I was like, that's great. Moments like that are good, but they're few and far between. And that's where you could have had, like, your stunt casting or your cameos or stuff like that. Other talents are being wasted. They're just like running their course like in a corner until they're ready to collide at the end of this and create like a big wreck. I didn't expect to be so hostile towards this film, to be quite honest with you. Like, it, watching it, it's just stupid and dumb and just kind of like a flat gangster comedy, I guess. But thinking about it now, I'm kind of like bummed, like, all around about it.
I've got to say this. I watched this movie last night starting at 11:30. It's a 2-hour movie, and I didn't even come close to falling asleep. Like, I sort of expected at any point in the middle, I was going to be like, okay, I need to pause this, finish this in the morning. And, like, I was watching without pausing the entire time. So, like, there's something about this. I think it just keeps moving. Like, even though you're not enjoying it or fully enjoying it or fully invested or whatever, there's so much happening. And also, when I'm watching these movies now and thinking about, like, well, who does this actor remind me of? Who can I recast them as? It's like this other level of, like, active viewing that, like, kept me engaged. And, like, it's not good. Like, I don't think you should see this movie. I think that if you want to see this movie, you can see it for free. At least as of when we're recording this, you can watch it for free on Amazon Prime. I guess sort of see the Charlize scenes. She's got the scene in the, I guess, watch the hotel scene, even though it's sort of unfortunate. She's really good in that. Then watch the other scenes, because, like, the other scenes, we can talk about those now. Like, she's really good. The fight scene is awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. They just beat the shit out of each other. Like, I was not, I did, that's probably, like, the 10%, part of the 10% I didn't remember about this movie was just, like, how hard they go at each other. It's like that movie, The House, that came out this year, when the two girls, like, fight each other for fight night. I was like, holy shit, they're like Krav Maga-ing.
Yeah, so Charlize is basically left to babysit. So this is after we find out that Terry Hatcher is in on the plan. She starts using the word they instead of he, like the killer's they. And Jeff Daniels, who is probably the worst character in this movie, he's also filled with impotent male rage. Maybe that's what this whole movie is about, just like different ways that men are broken. His wife left him, right? That we find out at the very, very end of the movie.
Yeah, and that he's psychologically unfit for duty, so he must render his badge.
I think that's because the wife left him. Like, I think the wife left him and he just, like, lost his mind. There's a golf course across the street from his house.
That's terrific.
Golfers keep breaking his windows, and so he pulls a gun on these golfers, and the one that they focus on is, like, this young black golfer. And I'm like, huh, L.A., 2 years after O.J., this seems not great. And, like, you know, he doesn't shoot the guy, but it's still like, oh, this is sort of a menacing use of cop privilege. But I was also like, you know, there's throughout the entire thing, it's like, you know, he's just yelling at Eric Stoltz. He's like, this is where I grew up. This is where I live. This is where my family is. Like, I'm not going to let, you know, massage parlors be in the valley. And he's like trying to clean up this, like, underbelly and trying to take down, we see this, like, probably 20-year-old or 18-year-old Vietnamese girl who is super sweet and, like, not crossing lines. And Eric Stoltz is, like, supposed to go in there and get, like, a happy ending and then, like, bust her. That's going to take down this establishment or something. But, like, even Eric Stoltz, like, immediately is like, this isn't how this is going to get done. And so then when they go to investigate the murder of Terry Hatcher's ex-husband, you know, Jeff Daniels is so angry, not at, like, just at life, that he's not paying attention to details, and he's just furious at Eric Stoltz. That's what I'm saying, like, Terry Hatcher's using, like, they, like, the killer's they. He's like, oh, no, that's just how people talk. But then that's how Eric Stoltz is like, oh, I think she's in on it. And so it's, like, these little things where Jeff Daniels, like, we don't find out till the very end that, like, his life is crumbling, but like you said earlier, like, just get rid of him.
Yeah, there's absolutely no reason for him to be there. He's an obstacle. It's just very strange. It's like, I don't want this movie to tackle issues. Like, why are you bringing up cop killers? And I don't want any of this to be ripped from the headlines. Like, let's just keep it on this Olympic athlete who wanted her husband killed. Don't bring in OJ. Don't bring in Rodney King. Don't bring in any of this, because it's really like, I mean, don't bring in this writer who wants to commit suicide. I mean, I think that's a cipher for the guy who wrote this movie. I think he's like, I wrote this movie and now I want to kill myself. You're dragging me so down, like, in the middle of something that's supposed to be like a black comedy or something dark and humorous. And as soon as you start bleeding that much into the real world, I can't come back as easily. Like, I can't snap back. If you're going to go from that scene of Jeff Daniels to Danny Aiello cooking pasta while he's holding people hostage and wants to shoot a dog, it's like, I can't alternate quick enough between these two dynamics here.
No, it's super strange. Getting way back to what I started before I went on that long tangent is that the next scene that Charlize is in, she's left to babysit Terry Hatcher after we find out that Terry Hatcher's in on it. Terry Hatcher and Charlize and James Spader are in a hotel room together. James Spader is going to go, where's he going? To the house, to get the money, right? From the closet?
Yeah, so that's another thing that we've left out of the details of sort of the whole murder plot, is that she's going to pay them 30 grand and she'll get the life insurance paid off.
No. She's getting half the life insurance. Like, she's getting a life insurance check and giving them half of that, too.
Oh, Jesus. Is it worth it? Like,
well,
she's
paying him alimony, so, like, I guess it's just worth it, because he's also creepy. I mean, if he's inviting himself over and sort of being rapey, she's paying him, she has to deal with him. The life insurance money is stuff that she wouldn't have otherwise, so I guess maybe?
It's just strange that she kept the money in the house. Like, if she had just known that James Spader was gonna show up to murder her husband, why didn't she just say, go to the, you know, and the money is in the safe? You know, like, I'll leave the money in the safe,
that's
whoever comes
thing.
To the house.
That's the whole thing, though, is that, like, she's saying, I didn't know that you were going to kill him in the house. I'd be like, why didn't you take the money out? Well, she's like, well, I didn't know you were going to kill him there. It's just another complication or bad communication where just, like, just say, hey, that money you want is in the safe, and if you're going to kill him at the house, also take the money or something.
Yeah, or why didn't James Spader say, you know, drop the money here, then we'll have a deal. Like, who really, do you get paid after the hit? I always thought it was before the hit. I mean, I don't know. I do know that in Suicide Squad, Deadshot wouldn't shoot until he was paid. So,
that direct deposit on his phone.
Yeah, I go by those rules.
James Spader leaves to go get the money, and Charlize is on the bed, because she basically flops out on the bed. Like, the whole scene, I was just watching her, just because we're watching this for that, but, like, she's doing more interesting things here than James Spader and Terry Hatcher are basically just, like, yelling at each other. Like, she's, like, flopping around, just, like, sort of like this, like, almost like a little kid, right? Like, because James Spader's significantly older than her. Like, she's 20, maybe, but she looks way older than 20. Like, and not, like, in a bad way. Like, in a, like, a look how confident and adult she is. You know what I mean? Like, just, like, how Cage never looked 18. She really doesn't look like she's just, like, a kid.
Yeah, I think a lot of that might have to do with, like, her stature. She's tall. Like, she's a pretty tall person, and so I think
she's 5'10".
She just exudes that sort of confidence and way she carries herself, but I agree. I love the way she's, like, using the scenery and, like, walking around the set and flopping on the bed or whatever. Like, what does kind of suck is she is just kind of furniture in this movie.
Right.
Which kind of blows. But what is kind of cool is, like, I think she knows that and she's using it in a way, and she's, like, acting like furniture at times. And, you know, if you can find anything to do that draws the attention of the viewer, I think that's a good thing. And she keeps it entertaining as opposed to just two people yelling at each other.
One thing that I liked of that earlier scene where she's, you know, in her underwear and James Spader's sort of talking down to her, you know, abusive or whatever, is that he says there's a cool line that I like where he says something like, you're not too tall, the rest of the world is just too short for you. Like, there's nothing wrong with you. You're perfect. It's the rest of the world that has a problem if they can't handle you. Considering how much of an object she's treated as in this movie, like, that's kind of empowering. Like, you get it. Like, you're not doing anything wrong. I'm gonna wind up killing you later, but it's not your fault. Like, you're perfect as you are, which I thought was kind of cool.
But she gets shot by Terry. He doesn't shoot her. It's like a mercy kill, right?
But I mean, I feel like, I don't think their relationship was gonna last.
No, probably not. I mean, I don't think they were gonna end up killing each other. You know, he was probably just gonna skip out on her with all the money or something. I feel like, you know, not driving her to the hospital, I guess that's the same thing as pulling the trigger.
He leaves to go get the money, and she's there on the bed, and she just, like, she basically turns into, like, a jungle cat, kind of, right? And she's just, like, taunting Terry Hatcher. I wrote down, she's animalistic. Like, she's just like, look how much power we have, and look how little power you have.
Oh, and then she starts talking about how good her ex-husband was, right? Or something? Like, I don't know why you wanted to get rid of that guy. Like,
it's
he was
so
good.
Weird.
Or something?
Yeah.
Like, she's like rubbing it in her face, like, I slept with your dead ex-husband that you had me kill.
Terry Hatcher starts, like, sort of respond to her, and Charlize shuts her down quick.
I don't give a shit about Roy, but those detectives, they were nice to me. I don't want to be a part of them being killed.
You know what? You shouldn't have left our money in your closet.
Well, how was I supposed to know you were gonna shoot Roy in my house?
Don't raise your voice at me.
Can't you call it off?
No! Now lower your voice, you little bitch.
What did you call me?
A bitch?
When she says that line, you're like, oh, right, like, Charlize is a bad guy. Like, it's not like, she's not, like, a good person. Like, she's a villain. And, like, that's super cool that she's in her first speaking part. She is basically not a killer, but she's sort of like an ice cold killer. Like, she's just like, I'm going to win, you're going to lose, and you have nothing to say about it.
So, you know what I started thinking around this scene? This isn't quite the recast game, but it's something similar, and it's sort of combining characters. And like, what I wanted to do is combine Charlize Theron and James Spader's character into one person and have it be played by Charlize.
Okay.
And have Terry Hatcher hire her to kill her husband, but then have her also have slept with her and, you know, all the same thing, but she also is the killer or the mastermind, and we just sort of get rid of James Spader, because then this would have been like a really great climax. Like, you could have had it all come out here. I don't know. I just thought that would have worked for me a little better. It would have given Charlize more to do, and I do like her as the villain. And, you know, we'll get her again in Fate of the Furious as a villain, but I think it's not going to really be until then that she, like, really puts on this hat in this way where she's, like, chewing the scenery and, I don't know, like, almost like a Batman villain at one point. Like,
yeah.
I'm going back to that because of James Spader, but I do feel like a lot of these are cartoon characters, and she really does a good job of expressing that type of tone.
And then it's through that tone, it's through that embodying the villain that we have this, like, incredible fight where they're just, like, throwing each other into things and, like, punching each other and really going all out, and it's great. And I realized, as we're recording this, we're about to announce the Keanu Club Awards are open for voting, which I think voting probably is either still open right now or maybe just closed. I want to start tracking things in real time in a document and do, like, best fight, because, like, whew, like, this one might be tough to top, because, like, it's just great.
I think we're seeing some sparks of Atomic Blonde here, you know?
Oh, that also might be tough to top. So yeah, yes, we see where that comes from. Absolutely.
But it is really cool to see her do action here, even if it's just this one scene, because she's going to go on to do, like, Mad Max down the line. Like, she, you know, like, it's just great that she's very versatile and she gets to be aggressive here and fight and stuff. And, you know, just like a lot of times, I feel like a lot of this stuff is just regulated to guys in movies. Like, you don't really get to see girls kick each other's asses all that much.
No.
I mean, it's just equality, but also, like, kind of fun just to see it mixed up a little bit.
That's why, to give a shout out to another show on our network, Too Fast, Too Forever, in Furious 6 or Fast and Furious 6, when Michelle Rodriguez and Gina Carano have that fight in the subway, you're like, oh, like,
yes.
I didn't know how much I wanted to see, like, two badass women just, like, go at it in a movie like this, because you don't think about how cool it can be just because nobody does it. And then, like, you see it in that movie or in this movie, you're like, oh, right, like, why isn't this happening more? Because you look at Terry Hatcher, it's not like you see, like, oh, she could really go, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like she, like, has this intimidating presence, but, like, she holds her own, and it's great.
Yeah, because her character is an Olympic athlete, so she's got stamina, she's got strength, she's got all that stuff. I mean, skiing, you gotta develop leg strength, arm strength, like, everything core. It's like a lot of core stuff, I feel.
Yeah.
So she is probably in great shape and probably knows a few fighting moves too. You know, if she's had to deal with Olympic coaches, I'm sure she's had to fight off a few of them. She's probably developed, like, a couple moves to pull. But yeah, and then Charlize, who knows what her character's background? We get zero from her. So for all we know, she could be special forces. She literally comes from nowhere. Like,
yep.
So it's cool to just know, like, she's just this wild, crazy person deep down, and she's just gonna explode in rage.
The fight ends as, like, does Charlize pull a gun? There's a gun that comes from somewhere.
I think the gun comes early, and then it, like, kicks off the fight, maybe, I think. And
there's a struggle, and we cut outside the hotel room, and we just hear a shot and a scream, and then Terry Hatcher sprints out, and we see Charlize in her, like, all-white jumpsuit, all-white pantsuit or whatever, just with this huge red blood stain on her side. And it reminds me, I've been thinking a lot lately as I record this, of Happy Death Day, which I loved, but, you know, in that movie, you know, Tree is wearing that white dress, and you're like, oh, she's gonna get murdered in that white dress. And, like, here again, like, it's this sort of this, like, not that she's pure, but, like, it's this, like, she is sort of like this unblemished, statuesque Eastern European woman, model, hitman, whatever, right? And then, like, to see her so obviously marred and, like, irreparably to the point where she's going to get killed in a couple minutes, it's a cool visual. And she, you know, chases after Terry Hatcher and shoots after her. And then, like we said earlier, somehow stumbles across town to show up at James Spader just like, I need help.
You know what I liked about her look is she kind of reminded me of, like, a ghost or, like, a ghost ninja or something like that at some point.
Ooh.
Like, she's wearing, like, that
ghost
one
ninja
piece. Yeah, it's, like, almost But it's almost like she's wearing like an X-Men outfit. Like she almost looks like Emma Frost or something, and that she's gonna turn to diamond at some point, or like throw you a psychic blast or something. But yeah, and I do like how the red contrasts to the white, you know, like when she's bleeding out. Like it's a very strong image. There's something ghastly about it. She gets all pale and stuff too, so even she's turning white. It's just very sort of horror movie ending for her character.
One thing I have a quick question, a sidetrack, is that when they're fighting, they cut to the hotel room below them, and there's an old couple.
Oh, yep.
Is that Peter Boyle?
I think that's Lawrence Tierney from Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, okay.
The fucking thing.
Because his wife is like, what are they doing up there? And he's like, maybe that's how they make love in Tarzana, which I don't know, like, that's in reference to, but like, all right, like, that's okay. But it was just sort of funny, like, to see that, like, that's a thing that worked for me. Because, like, the whole movie, like, every character in this movie is crazy, sort of, right? Like, they're all, like, they've all got murder on their brain, or, you know, cleaning, or, like, Jeff Daniels, like, unhinged, trying to clean up the valley. And then just to see, like, a normal couple, like, what is going on up there? Like, I don't have any idea. Like, that was funny to me, just sort of, like, the normal reaction to the madness that this movie sets as sort of, like, the status quo.
He's listed as older man, and it is Lawrence Tierney. The only reason I recognized him is because he's the guy in Reservoir Dogs, and that this is such, like, a Pulp Fiction-y type of movie.
Okay.
I was like, that's like a Easter egg or something, I guess.
I thought, because I have in my brain, because Peter Boyle was on one of the absolute best episodes of The X-Files right around this time. I want to find out when.
And one of my favorite all-time Cage Club films.
Which movie?
Honeymoon in Vegas.
Oh, right.
When they go to Hawaii, he's the chief.
Mm.
Love show tunes.
Because he's Clyde Bruckman in Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose, which is from 95, from season 3. Widely considered, and by my, like, maybe my favorite episode. Definitely top 5. It's just around that time, and just sort of like, you know, this kind old man or whatever. I was just like, oh, maybe that's him. But Reservoir Dogs connection makes more sense. But they leave the hotel, and they all go to this house, and everything converges. And I realized Keith Carradine and his female partner, and I only mentioned that she's female partner because we mentioned her earlier, and she has literally nothing to do in this movie. They're there investigating. And James Spader shows up and kills both of them, including blowing kisses to sort of distract Keith Carradine and then shooting him. So, like, I feel like James Spader is making the most out of a terribly written character. Like, I can't imagine how boring this guy is on the page. Like, I feel like he's doing the best with absolutely nothing to work with. That we've seen him be really good in Sex, Lies, and Videotape. We've seen him be good in other stuff. There's probably nothing there. And I'm giving him, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm giving him all the credit in terms of doing something with this role and making it not great, but better than it has any right to be.
I'm going to agree with you on that. I think he's a great actor. I think he probably found moments like the blowing the kisses or weird looks that he gives, or just his straight up kind of menacing quality that he has. Like, he just retains like this very, like, you can't really read him, you know? Like, I don't know. There's just something blank about him. That works for this guy. It keeps him aloof. Like, it makes him unpredictable. He's a wild card. And it actually works in a lot of ways at times. Like, his character is what I like about, like, where the comedy comes out. Like, let the comedy come out of these stupid characters instead of, like, jokes and stuff like that, or situational humor.
Yeah.
Like, let it just be, like, his mannerisms and his thing with the watch, which I don't think he did enough. That's the one thing. I feel like he really could have pushed, like, before he went into that house to kill the two cops, he should have given himself a minute.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's very strange. So Eric Stoltz shows up. James Spader grabs the badge to show that he's a cop. And I realize in this moment that Eric Stoltz in movie number 2 is a better cop than we had in any Cage movie. 80 movies in or whatever, Eric Stoltz is a better cop, a better detective, more observant, better at his job. And he's basically like a rookie cop than any cop. Like the only ones that, you know, are high watermark for Cage Club was Timothy Olyphant and Delroy Lindo in Gone in 60 Seconds. But like, they're sort of just good at what they do. Like, he's like finding clues and like following up on leads and like,
yeah, he knows actually what's more important to keep your, you know, like, he's like, let's not bust this little like massage parlor. Like, what's the point of that? Like, it's just a massage, you know, like, that's a nothing. Like, this is a murder. Like, we got to focus on the murder.
And he only makes it through this movie because Charlize shows up to distract James Spader from killing him. He goes outside and Danny Aiello shows up to sort of distract James Spader from killing him. And then he's still going to die. And that's only when Terry Peppers or whatever, the suicidal writer shows up. Teddy Peppers shows up and like shoots and ultimately kills James Spader. But like, he has to be saved by 3 different people, which, I mean, that's why he's sort of Akigappi's not good at what he does, but he's still a good investigator, which I sort of appreciated in terms of, because you saw dumb cop after dumb cop after dumb cop. Keanu Club was a little bit better because Keanu played more cops and Speed and all these other movies where he's like actually good at investigating. But
Point Break.
But here, you know, we get a good cop. He might be the high watermark. We'll have to see. But he's a pretty good way to start things off.
What bothers me about this character is we never follow him home. We never see any family life. We don't know what he likes to do with his time off. Like, I just wish the movie was about him or something, like, or more about him, or we spent more time with him. Like, why are we following his partner home when he never returns? Like, as soon as he gets that letter, he's out of the movie, if I'm not mistaken. Like, he's gone. Just write him out before you start writing the screenplay. If we followed Good Cop around more, and then we'd probably be, like, way more invested in whether or not he's gonna get shot for the third time. Because by the third time, I'm like, he's obviously someone else is gonna come. It's just a matter of who they chose out of a hat to be the surprise guy to show up at the end and save his life.
Yep, but so Charlize saves his life, and then he's gonna, James Spader's gonna mercy kill her, and she asks for a minute. And I was like, oh, as soon as she asks for a minute, I'm like, she's not gonna die here. And I was like, is she gonna make it through this movie? She doesn't make it through this movie, but she does escape off the couch.
Yeah.
Because that's when Danny Aiello shows up, right? And he gets distracted again, or no?
I can't remember. I got things mixed up. Spader comes back and she's dying in the hotel room and gets away and runs down the street. And then I think that's what happens.
No. They're at the house.
Oh, that's at the house?
That's at the house. She shows because she stumbles across town to the house. And then he's about to shoot her, and then the gun jams and he walks away.
Yeah, so she runs outside. Stoltz shows up. Then Aiello shows up.
Right.
I think. Yeah.
Yes. She sort of helped Spader get caught because he would have gotten away, but it became like this whole big thing. So her death is not really in vain, I don't think. But then there's a whole big shootout and Teddy Pepper saves the day, and it's like, oh, okay. And then what's weird is that Terry Hatcher gets away with it.
Yeah, not only Terry Hatcher, but Eric Stoltz lets Danny Aiello leave with $30,000.
Yep.
He's like, you could just go.
Yeah.
I was like, what do you mean you could just go? He like basically is like, put the cuffs on me, like, arrest me, officer, I'm ready to repent. And Eric Stoltz is like, nah, it's the valley, pal.
It's like, in this crazy mixed up world, sometimes the bad guys are better than the good guys. Or like, I don't know, who knows? But yeah, so Terry Hatcher gets away with it, or at least she's like a free woman now. I don't know if she has, because she doesn't have the insurance money, she doesn't have the $30,000, but she has like a new life. Yeah. She's not caught, she doesn't go to jail for hiring hitmen to kill her husband. Danny Aiello gets away with the mousy assistant. Everybody else, and Eric Stoltz, I guess, is alive and okay, but like, everybody else dies.
Oh, the British guy gets knocked out and left at his house, so we never see him wake up.
That's absolutely fine by me.
I guess now's as good a time as any to just mention the guy who plays Teddy. This guy is like one of my favorite directors, Paul Mazursky. Like, he is such a great director. I think he's since passed away. Stuff like Down and Out in Beverly Hills or Moon Over Parador, Moscow on the Hudson. I really enjoy his movies. I can't tell you how much. I never seen him act before. I didn't know he was an actor. And I can't stand him in this movie. And
really?
I feel kind of bad about that. Yeah, I just feel like he's out of everybody in the movie, not that he's miscast, but just that character doesn't feel like it belongs
anywhere. Well, I don't think it's his fault. I mean, what I did like is that we start off with a Cage moment in that he's shaving.
Oh, yes.
I'm like, oh, because like he's so low build on Letterboxd. He's like 12th, and I was like, oh, he can't be important. And then he just shows up in every scene. The whole movie, he's just trying to give away this dog so that he can kill himself at his wife's grave or something. I don't know. But yeah, like, I agree. Like, I don't think it's his fault that he's bad or that you don't like him. I think it's just, like, there's no reason for him to exist in this. Because, like, literally anyone else could have saved the day. Like, Jeff Daniels could have come and saved the day. You know what I mean? Like,
that would have made more sense.
Yeah.
To save his partner.
Yeah.
Right before turning in his badge forever or whatever.
Yep.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Like, I just think it's probably the character. But I was just shocked because of what a great director he is and how bad I felt his performance came across. So.
Well, Jeff Daniels will have a chance to redeem himself. He'll be in Trial and Error, which I think we're doing in 2 or 3 movies with Charlize.
Whatever that is. Never heard of that.
So he's back.
And Kramer's in that movie, too.
Ooh.
So
the only other note that I had about this movie was that Charlize's part was originally written for Daphne Deckers, who I don't know who she is. She's actually from Europe. She's like, she was born somewhere like in Norway or Sweden or somewhere. She had conflicts or something, so the part went to Charlize. So like, it's a sliding doors universe that we live in where like, because she was busy, Charlize is now a movie star and we're talking about her. You know what I mean? Like, it's weird how things happen, but that's how we got here. And one other thing that I saw on IMDb that just is frustrating in terms of the overall scope of what we're doing is that the most interesting, quote-unquote interesting trivia, 14 of 14 people found it interesting, was that this is the first movie with a nude scene by Charlize Theron. It's just like, oh, okay, like, cool, good job, creepy guys, like, just thumbs-upping that on IMDb. But that's true, you know, she is naked in this movie if you want to see that, but...
You know what vibe I kind of got at one point during this, just because of how gratuitous everything was, is Wild Things? Did you ever see Wild Things?
I've seen, the offending scenes in Wild Things when I was younger.
I mean, it just has that really trashy sort of dime store novel. Even the name, 2 Days in the Valley, kind of just, like, it just grabs you, and I feel like the title's even better than what it delivers.
Yeah,
it just got the same sort of, like, dirtiness from it. It's just like, we're just gonna be gratuitous and, like, boobs or nudity or blood or,
yep,
you know,
mm-hmm,
this is like, we think this is cool. Like the fucking art dealer's house gave me a goddamn headache because of how much, like, crazy, cool, wacky shit is in it, you know? Like, all the different sculptures and stuff.
And what's weird is that, like, he's even paying attention to the sculptures. Like, the actor in character is like, wait, we're just leaving here, like, this, like, outline of, like, a person spanking another person? Like, this is just... He's like, all right, I guess, like, because if you live there, you would just not pay second thought to any of it, right? But, like,
yeah,
he's like, he, you can see him looking at the stuff around him, like, oh, we're leaving this here? Oh, okay.
And I couldn't tell if he was an art dealer or if those were his pieces. Like, is he a sculptor? Like, that is so unclear whether he, and if he is an art dealer, like, what art dealer keeps your inventory in your actual house? Like, are those pieces that he's bought? Is he a collector? There you go. I'm just so confused by it.
And the other thing is that throughout this entire movie, Danny Aiello has a fear of dogs, and there's just dogs everywhere in this movie. So that's the only other, like, sort of a noteworthy thing to point out.
And the toupee, he looks way better with the toupee. I'm sorry, movie, but that is just a bad call. You're reaching for a moment where this person's trying to accept him for who he is.
Finding your inner beauty, like, just embracing who you are, but yeah.
But don't lie about it. You should be like, you should be confident you can wear and rock that toupee, man. Like, you look good. Like,
yep,
be toupee boy.
I don't know.
Fine.
Any other thoughts about 2 Days in the Valley before we get to the recast game?
You know, another movie this reminded me of around the same time that I enjoy way a lot more, with a lot less characters and is way funnier, but also kind of, like, violent, is Get Shorty. I feel like it's got kind of like a Get Shorty feel trying to go for it too. But, you know, that had Barry Sonnenfeld behind the wheel in what some may claim, like, around his heyday. Like, he was really firing on all cylinders back in the 90s. So I don't know if this definitely doesn't reach that standard. I mean, just watch the kind of stuff, like we mentioned in here, that we like the fight scene, or, you know, maybe just the Charlize Theron stuff, maybe some of the James Spader stuff. You know, looking back on it 20 years later, I can't believe how different I feel about this movie.
So, like, in your brain, had you, like, been thinking, like, oh yeah, I like that movie?
Yeah. I think I even mentioned in the last episode, I was like, yeah, next week's gonna be, like, pretty good movie with a lot of, like, good actors. And,
well, you remember that it was an ensemble piece. You got that part right. I know that for sure.
I definitely expected to have a much better time revisiting this movie than I did. I just really don't feel like it holds up.
Well, we are past it. Next week is going to be That Thing You Do, which is going to be a delight. So mm-hmm, I'm very excited for that. But now, time for the recast game.
This is fun. We haven't done games in the previous 2 actor podcasts, so I'm really enjoying this so far. So, Joey, here we go.
Yep.
We're going to start with Terry Hatcher.
Let's
go with Becky first.
Okay.
What do you have for Becky?
So this is the first, I mean, we've only done this, I guess we've done this 3 times, because we did it on the Affleck movie that we didn't release.
The Secret Pilot.
But that movie and last week's and this one, this is the first one I really had, like, multiples for everyone, because I kept, like, having, but, like, never really feeling right. Like, once I got, like, the right casting, I stopped.
Yeah.
So for Terry Hatcher, I first wrote down Kristen Stewart, which I think would be okay. And then I was like, well, and then I wrote down Jenna Malone, who you might know from The Neon Demon. And then what I wound up on is Allison Williams from Get Out and from Girls.
Nice.
I think that she could just do that, like, oh, like, I can't, like, because it's basically from Get Out in my brain where it's like that switch that's flipped where it's like,
yeah,
like, she's innocent.
She's a two-face.
So you're like, oh, she's in on it.
Right.
Sorry, babe.
Yeah, she's playing that role where she's all nice and sweet, but
yep,
then it's actually, no, I'm luring you to your death.
Yep. And as long as we have if we recast and we remake this movie, we need to have another scene where she's, like, silently, creepily drinking milk on her bed. Like, that scene from Get Out, which is just, like, super, super creepy and weird, but
or just drinking everything through straws,
yep,
just to give her, like, an extra
yep
weirdness.
Yep.
I like that more than I like that. I like that more than my choice.
Who was yours?
I think I had Happy Death Day on the mind too much because I watched it right before this. But I'm going with the daughter of Birdie herself, Ruby Modine, who plays the lead actress's roommate in that movie. I think she'd be good. She's got like that pep. She's got also like sort of that dark edge as well, sort of that two-faced nature to her character, and the look. And I think she kind of has like a bit of the look as well. So I'm going with her. I think she's the youngest actress that, or actor that I've I'm going to mention tonight. All right, so we got her done. Why don't we move on? How about we go? Let's okay. So now let's go with we'll go by story. So let's do the Danny Aiello characters first, and let's go with Danny Aiello.
Okay. So I said earlier that I did James Gandolfini. I also wrote down John Travolta because I was like, oh, this is kind of like a Pulp Fiction. But what I wound up with, which I think it would be so bad, Steven Seagal.
Oh my God. Like, he would be terrible, but that's a great choice.
That's why, because I'm like, this is not, I don't think it's a great character. I think you sort of need someone who can be that, like, because his whole thing is like, hey, I'm Italian, I'm going to cook you pasta. I just want to sort of see Steven Seagal in that role. I mean,
that's
if we're trying to make a good movie, I think Travolta would be better. I think Gandolfini would be better, you know, in terms of recasting the part as it is, Steven Seagal.
Wow, I went a totally different direction with that, because I found the role to sort of try and be more comical. I actually went with Zach Galifianakis. I actually had like a little ensemble idea with those three people in the kitchen.
Okay.
So he's part of the three there. But I don't know. I like when Galifianakis kind of like loses his patience and gets flustered and frustrated, and he never really plays like a straight up bad guy. So it'd be cool to kind of see him.
I like that.
With like all the power in the room.
Yeah.
Next, let's do the British guy Alan that they're in his house that he's like sort of holding him hostage.
Originally, I wrote down Rob Brydon from the trip to Spain, Italy. What I went to, and I'm not sure if this is better or worse, because I think that there comes a point where, like, how many A-list celebrities can you cast in one of these movies? But, you know, they're whatever. I went with Jude Law, which I think would work well,
good,
too.
Good.
Either one of those I'm okay with. Just, like, that, like, snarky British guy who, like, you kind of like, but also kind of hate.
Yeah, I love Rob Brydon as that. I don't see him in enough American stuff.
Yeah.
He was on this HBO show called The Brink, which I fucking love to this day. Oh my God, and I consider it one of the best TV shows ever that never got picked up, but that's a whole other
that
podcast.
That was from the hallowed Sunday night of Ballers, The Brink, True Detective season 2, which I wound up really liking season 2, especially with my girl Rachel McAdams as Antigone Bezerides.
I like your picks. I went sort of the Jude Law direction, I guess you could say, with my Alan, and I'm going with Loki, Tom Hiddleston.
Oh, okay.
I like him. At first I was thinking of a Doctor Who. I was going to pick a Doctor Who because they're just all these like loud British dudes that yell a lot, but I think Loki or Tom Hiddleston could bring better dimension to calm down and quiet it up a little bit.
I really want to see like a mismatched buddy cop movie with Zach Galifianakis and Loki now and Tom Hiddleston. Like, that would be great.
I got a little bit of like a theory going on, or a method to my casting here.
The next one you want to do is the mousy assistant, Susan.
Yeah, the assistant Susan to round this out. Yeah.
My decision for this is that I wanted to cast a beautiful actress that they could just sort of frizzy up. My first pick was Olivia Cooke, who was from Bates Motel. She is the...
Okay.
She's not the blonde one that he has a crush on. She's the one with the oxygen tank. More recently, which I don't know if it's out yet. I think it's coming out early next year, which I saw at Fantastic Fest. She's great in Thoroughbreds, which is really, really fun.
Oh,
really, really
I just
good.
Saw the trailer for that.
Yes.
That looks awesome. I've seen her in The Signal.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
What I wound up going with was Emma Stone.
Oh, nice.
Because I think she hasn't really... I don't know if she's done it in a while, but like she could definitely play that like sort of like frazzled, like, oh, I can't do anything right, but like all you have to do is like take off her glasses and like, oh, she's beautiful.
Didn't she sort of play like the nerd in The House Bunny or something?
I haven't seen that. That's the Anna Faris movie?
Yeah.
I feel like she's done that a lot. She's done it before. I also wrote down Michelle Pfeiffer because it's because of New Year's Eve. Like, you just need someone beautiful who can sort of play cute, but also like smarter than she looks, and just like, I don't know. It's easy to do that one, but also really difficult to sort of nail it. I'm not sure if I I'm not super happy with it, but I'm going to go with Emma Stone.
All right. And you already know my pick because I kind of accidentally spoiled
it.
Last night while Googling, but I'm going with Kristen Schaal for that role.
Yep.
I just think it's like a perfect fit for her as an actress. And I mean, I don't really watch a lot of her lately. I just love her on Flight of the Conchords. That's where like I really became a fan of hers as the obsessive fan of the guys and stuff. I really think that she could pull this off really well. I think like her turn to sort of empowerment would be a lot stronger. Like I could almost see her punching out Tom Hiddleston at one point. Definitely like her and Zach Galifianakis, I feel, would have like really good chemistry.
Yeah, and she's also really great in The Last Man on Earth, and also she's the best part of Bob's Burgers, which, you know, I took the animated Gene Belcher for the movie last week. I knew that you would cast her as something, so when I was watching the movie, I'm like, even before I saw her, just when she was on the phone, when he calls her from the car, and I was like, oh, that's Kristen Schaal. Like, that's, so that was, I think that's why I was having a hard time casting it, because that's sort of perfect.
Thanks. Maybe I have a future as a casting
agent.
Who knows? Okay, let's do the cops now. So let's do Eric Stoltz, Wes.
So I cast the cops together, and it's weird that you actually brought it up. Well, because I sort of brought it up first, but I cast Gosling as Eric Stoltz and Russell Crowe as Jeff Daniels, because I'm like, this is the nice, it's the nice guys. And so I almost cast, instead of Allison Williams for Terry Hatcher, I almost cast Margaret Qualley, who is the damsel in distress in The Nice Guys. But I was like, two is enough. But just like, that's the movie that he wanted to make with those characters, I feel. And so when you brought it up earlier, I was like, well, there we go. It's a small part for Gosling and also a small part for Russell Crowe, but like, I think that that's the best version, I think, of that duo, and I think that would work.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there's no reason to like just not implant those exact characters into this movie even. I was also getting a little bit of a Training Day vibe off of them, like Denzel and Ethan Hawke almost.
Oh,
but
speaking of that, sorry to interrupt you. You know what else I got? It's a low rent Gary Busey Keanu situation from Point Break also.
Good call. I didn't really cast these guys as like playing off each other in the way that you might have, but I just kind of casted them more separately. But for Eric Stoltz, I went with Domhnall Gleeson.
Okay.
You know that guy, right?
Yes. What did I just see him in? Oh, he's an American Maid.
Yeah. So he was just recently in that and like Ex Machina and a lot of great stuff. And I think partially I went with him because he's a ginger like Eric Stoltz. Like they both got red hair, so it's kind of in that mode. And then for Jeff Daniels, I wanted to see a really destroyed, bearded, and maybe overweight Chris Pratt.
Oh, okay.
And see him get like dark and disturbed and really like mean and everything. I haven't seen him get angry on screen yet.
Interesting. I like that.
Cool. So I think we only have two more.
We have the Charlize one, which you can do last. We have the James Spader role, and we have the Paul Mazursky Teddy Peppers role.
Okay, so let's do Teddy. Let's do the Paul Mazursky guy now. So this was the
last minute addition to our casting.
This is the suicidal writer.
I cast him just because I think he looks like him sort of, and because I have him on the brain because he's just on Mark Maron's podcast. Beau Bridges, I think, would do this pretty well.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I was going for sort of something close to that at first. I was like, let me go with someone who's like really good and established to really beef up this role. But ultimately, I had to go with my gut, and I went with Tommy Wiseau. I think it would have been amazing. I think there's a bit of that in this character already.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
I think that'll work.
That'll work. Next.
James Spader. Lee. The One Minute Man.
Lee. I was back and forth between two people. Originally, I had Christoph Waltz.
Oh my God. I didn't even think.
Who I think would be really good. What I wound up with is Michael Pitt from Funny Games, from Boardwalk Empire. Almost too handsome for his own good. Demented killer sort of thing. Quiet confidence. Don't mess with him. I can see him wearing all white like I think he does in Funny Games, you know what I mean? Just like a sort of a perfect unblemished psycho.
I actually only watched Boardwalk Empire up until his exit.
I only watched the first season.
Okay, I thought he was the core of that show. I really like that pick. I thought I saw him in something recently too, I can't remember, but he's a good actor I don't feel like I've seen enough of. I went a little different. It's funny, I had Gosling down at one point, but I was just like, no, that just doesn't fit. I went a little older. This was also kind of tough. I had a couple suggestions, but this I actually tried to cast, like, for real. Who would I really want to see do this? And I kind of want to see Jeremy Renner play this role. Like, I don't know if that's a good casting, but he's got that thing behind the eyes sometimes. Like, whether he's playing a good guy or a bad guy, like, he just seems like you don't want to mess with him. And I think, like, he would have just, like, it wouldn't have been as funny, but I think it would have been scarier.
Definitely.
But that was definitely the one I struggled with the most. Because I just feel like Spader nailed it, too. Yeah. Like, that's just a really hard one to recast.
It's also hard to gauge how old he is in this.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like maybe 30, but also maybe 25 or maybe 40. Like, I don't know who to sort of, like, I feel like that could be played by a lot of people, which sort of makes it easier and more difficult all at once.
He just looks so drastically different than he does today. I mean, people look different as they age and everything, but I was just, like, shocked when he came up on screen. I was like, whoa, he's really young looking in this movie.
But he's very recognizable, too, still, I think.
So. Oh, absolutely.
Last part to recast, the Charlize Theron.
Helga.
I originally had Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Which I said. Then I went to Elle Fanning, and I was like, that's not quite. But I was like, who is basically the new hot blonde? And I went with Margot Robbie, but I still feel like there's probably a new Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if this was 2013, like Wolf of Wall Street time, like this, that would be her, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm probably missing out someone. The other name I wrote down, which I don't think that she, I mean, maybe, is Kate Upton.
Okay.
I'm not thrilled. I think Margot Robbie is a better pick. I'm still not thrilled. I feel like I'm missing someone obvious.
Yeah, this was a tough one because I don't really, I mean, there's the girl from Happy Death Day. Like, she would have been great. I don't know if this is exactly, like, it's hard. Like, I feel like, I guess you could find someone new, but if we have to recast it with somebody who's already been in stuff, like, I also was thinking Margot Robbie. I was thinking, like, Jennifer Lawrence, you know? Like, I don't know. Like, it's weird. Ultimately, in the end, I took a page out of your notebook from last week.
Oh.
I casted a cartoon character.
Okay.
I'm gonna send you the photo right now so you can see.
And
I don't know if you're aware of this movie Cool World.
I am not.
But there is a character, Kim Basinger plays her, and the character's name is Holly Wood, and she is, like, basically looks exactly like Charlize Theron in this movie, but she's a cartoon. I hate to do it, but again, I don't think, like, this is a very strong role to begin with. The movie could almost be made without it. It's unfortunate as she's just a sex object, and so that's what I did, I guess. I just recast it with a sex object, this Holly Wood, this just, like, kind of a, the movie is sort of, like, mocking that whole concept of, like, chauvinism or anything. It's not a good movie. Don't watch Cool World. Like, it's not, I mean, Brad Pitt is in it, but it's not good or anything. But, I mean, I just did what I had to do, I guess. I don't feel good about it.
I was also thinking for this role, when I wrote down Elle Fanning, I was also thinking, like, Bella Heathcote and Abby Lee, the other models from Neon Demon. And, like, I think they would might be, like, I also wrote down, did I write down for this one? I might have crossed it out. Riley Keough. Like, I was basically thinking, like, either a model from the Neon Demon or any of the brides or the wives from Mad Max. You know what I mean? Like, they could all sort of, like, it's just that, but it's all, like, the same kind of pool of women. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, like, all sort of models turned actress. Because, like, you basically need someone physically flawless who can hold her own in a fight and who can be kind of, like, an ice-cold killer, sort of. And, like, it's hard. And I think the whole thing, like you were saying, is, like, she works in this because she's this brand-new, never-before-seen face, right? And, like, it's hard to do that here because, like, you know, we have to know somebody. Like, we just have to find somebody off the street, basically, which sort of doesn't work.
I mean, the one thing you really just got to get is, like, the strength. Like, the someone who could kick, like, someone else's ass, I guess. Like, Amber Heard, maybe, or something? I don't know.
Oh, I like that.
That could work. Maybe I'll go with her, finally, for the end.
I think last thoughts about 2 Days in the Valley, or are we set to move on to That Thing You Do next
week? Yeah, I am ready to go hear some Oneaters.
We found, just before we started recording this, that we found that there is a 2.5-hour director's cut on Blu-ray. So it's available to watch on Amazon, I think, right?
Well,
Mike?
No, so the theatrical cut, I could only find a theatrical cut on Amazon yet, but apparently this director's cut came out 10 years ago on DVD, and I'm just finding out about it today, so.
Oh, actually, That Thing You Do is also on Stars. I don't know if...
That's also the theatrical cut.
Okay.
Because that's what they run on television.
Gotcha. So yeah, so there's an hour and 40-minute version. We're going to watch a 2-hour, 27-minute version.
Who knew?
Which has a lot more Charlize, so maybe a lot more songs.
Or at least a lot more of that one song.
I'm super excited.
How many times did they play that song in the movie? I'm gonna have to count.
We're gonna have to count it. I listened to it twice this morning. That's all I know.
I've already heard it twice today as well, so. Because I started watching the theatrical cut and I listened to the song before I started watching the movie.
So come back next week for That Thing You Do. But for all things Watch the Theron, including last week's episode of Children of the Corn 3, Urban Harvest, you can go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter. You can find all the episodes of this show, all of our other shows, Too Fast, Too Forever, launched a week ago with this show. On Monday, we are launching Magic Mike's The Channing Tatum Podcast. And then next Friday, no, like two Thursdays from now or something. Yeah, two Thursdays from now, I think, on the 21st, the Ryan Gosling podcast Boyfriend Material will come up. So all three of those shows, all episodes of this show, all of our other shows that we've talked about, Cage Club, Keanu Club, Zack Attack, everything else on our network, cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, and at cageclubpod on Twitter. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And we'll see you next time on Watch the Theron. Watch the Theron. I'm going to get it right one of these times. Watch the Theron.